This is Audible.
Random House Audiobooks presents Jazz by Toni Morrison. Read for you by the author.
Jazz. I know that woman. She used to live with a flock of birds on Lenox Avenue. Know her husband, too. He fell for an 18-year-old girl with one of those deep-down spooky loves that made him so sad and happy he shot her just to keep the feeling going. When the woman, her name is Violet, went to the funeral to see the girl and to cut her dead face, they threw her to the floor and out of the church. She ran then through all that snow. And when she got back to her apartment, she took the birds from their cages and set them out the windows to freeze or fly, including the parrot that said, "I love you." The snow she ran through was so windswept, she left no footprints in it. So for a time, nobody knew exactly where on Lenox Avenue she lived. But like me, they knew who she was, who she had to be, because they knew that her husband, Joe Trace, was the one who shot the girl. There was never anyone to prosecute him because nobody actually saw him do it, and the dead girl's aunt didn't want to throw money to helpless lawyers or laughing cops when she knew the expense wouldn't improve anything. Besides, she found out that the man who killed her niece cried all day, and for him and for Violet, that is as bad as jail. She's awfully skinny, Violet. 50, but still good-looking when she broke up the funeral. You'd think that being thrown out the church would be the end of it, the shame and all, but it wasn't. Violet is mean enough and good-looking enough to think that even without hips or youth, she could punish Joe by getting herself a boyfriend and letting him visit her in her own house. She thought it would dry his tears up and give her some satisfaction as well. It could have worked, I suppose, but the children of suicides are hard to please and quick to believe no one loves them, because they're not really here. Violet's next plan, to fall back in love with her husband, whipped her before it got on a good footing. Washing his handkerchiefs and putting food on the table before him was the most she could manage. So she decided to love, well, find out about, the 18-year-old, whose creamy little face she tried to open, even though nothing would have come out but straw. She questioned everybody, starting with Mel Vaughn, an upstairs neighbor, the one who told her about Joe's dirt in the first place, and whose apartment he and the girl used as a love nest. From Mel Vaughn, she learned the girl's address and whose child she was. From the legally licensed beauticians, she found out what kind of lip rouge the girl wore, the marcelling iron they used on her, though I suspect that girl didn't need to straighten her hair. The band the girl liked best, Slim Bates, Ebony Keys. And when she was shown how, Violet did the dance steps the girl used to do. For a long time, she pestered the girl's aunt, a dignified lady who did fine work off and on in the garment district, until the aunt broke down and began to look forward to Violet's visits for a chat about youth and misbehavior. The aunt showed all the dead girl's things to Violet, and it became clear to her, as it was to me, that this niece had been hard-headed as well as sly. One particular thing the aunt showed her, and eventually let Violet keep for a few weeks, was a picture of the girl's face, not smiling, but alive at least, and very bold. Violet had the nerve to put it on the fireplace mantel in her own parlor, and both she and Joe looked at it in bewilderment. It promised to be a mighty bleak household, what with the birds gone and the two of them wiping their cheeks all day. But when spring came to the city, Violet saw, coming into the building with an okay record under her arm and carrying some stew meat wrapped in butcher paper, another girl with four marceled waves on each side of her head. Violet invited her in to examine the record, and that's how that scandalizing threesome on Lenox Avenue began. What turned out different was who shot whom. I'm crazy about this city. Daylight slants like a razor, cutting the buildings in half. In the top half, I see looking faces, and it's not easy to tell which are people, which the work of stonemasons. Below is shadow, where any blasé thing takes place. Clarinets and lovemaking, fists and the voices of sorrowful women. A city like this one makes me dream tall and feel in on things. When I look over the strips of green grass lining the river, at church steeples and into the cream and copper halls of apartment buildings, I'm strong. Alone, yes, but top-notch and indestructible. Like the city in 1926, when all the wars are over and there will never be another one. Nobody says it's pretty here. Nobody says it's easy either. What it is decisive. And if you pay attention to the street plans all laid out, city can't hurt you. I haven't got any muscles, so I can't really be expected to defend myself. But I do know how to take precaution. Mostly it's making sure no one knows all there is to know about me. Second, I watch everything and everyone and try to figure out their plans, their reasonings, long before they do. You have to understand what it's like taking on a big city. I'm exposed to all sorts of ignorance and criminality. Still, this is the only life for me. Armistice was 8 years old the winter Violet disrupted the funeral, and veterans on 7th Avenue were wearing their Army-issue greatcoats because nothing they can pay for is as sturdy or hides so well what they had boasted of in 1919. Up there on Lenox, in Violet and Joe Tracy's apartment, the rooms are like the empty bird cages wrapped in cloth, and a dead girl's face has become a necessary thing for their nights. They each take turns to throw off the bed covers, rise up from the sagging mattress and tiptoe over cold linoleum into the parlor to gaze at what seems like the only living presence in the house, the photograph of a bold, unsmiling girl staring from the mantelpiece. If the tiptoer is Joe Trace, driven by loneliness from his wife's side, then the face stares at him without hope or regret. And it is the absence of accusation that wakes him from his sleep, hungry for her company. No finger points. Her lips don't turn down in judgment. Her face is calm, generous, and sweet. But if the tiptoer is Violet, the photograph is not that at all. The girl's face looks greedy, haughty, and very lazy. Two or three times during the night, as they take turns to go look at that picture, one of them will say her name. Dorcas? Dorcas. The dark rooms grow darker. The parlor needs a struck match to see the face. Beyond are the dining room, two bedrooms, the kitchen, all situated in the middle of the building, so the apartment's windows have no access to the moon or the light of a street lamp. Violet and Joe have arranged their furnishings in a way that might not remind anybody of the rooms in Modern Homemaker, but it suits the habits of the body, the way a person walks from one room to another without bumping into anything, and what he wants to do when he sits down. Everything is put where a person would like to have it, or would use or need it. So the dining room doesn't have a dining table, with funeral parlor chairs. It has big, deep-down chairs and a card table by the window covered with jade, dracaena, and doctor plants until they want to have card games or play tonk between themselves. The kitchen is roomy enough to accommodate 4 people eating, or give a customer plenty leg room while Violet does her hair. The front room, or parlor, is not wasted either, waiting for a wedding reception to be worthy of. It has bird cages and mirrors for the birds to look at themselves in. But now, of course, there are no birds. The mantle over the fireplace used to have shells and pretty colored stones, but all of that is gone now, and only the picture of Dorcas Manfred sits there in a silver frame, waking them up all night long. Such restless nights make them sleep late, and Violet has to hurry to get a meal prepared before getting ready for her round of heads. Having a knack for it, but no supervised training and therefore no license to do it, Violet can only charge 25 or 50 cents anyway. But since that business at Dorcas's funeral, many of her regular customers have found reasons to do their own hair or have a daughter heat up the irons. Violet and Joe Trace didn't used to need that hairdressing pocket change, but now that Joe is skipping work days, Violet carries her tools and her trade more and more into the overheated apartments of women who wake in the afternoon, pour gin in their tea, and don't care what she has done. These women always need their hair done, and sometimes pity darkens their shiny eyes, and they tip her a whole dollar. This morning, she's grateful that the customer who is coming to her kitchen for an appointment is not due until 3 o'clock, and there's time for a bit of housekeeping before then. Some business that needs doing, because it is impossible to have nothing to do, no sequence of errands, lists of tasks. While she sprinkles the collar of a white shirt, her mind is at the bottom of the bed, where the leg, broken clean away from the frame, is too split to nail back. When the customer comes and Violet is sudsing the thin gray hair, murmuring "Have mercy" at the appropriate breaks in the old lady's stream of confidences. Violet is resituating the cord that holds the stove door to its hinge and rehearsing the month's plea for 3 more days to the rent collector. She thinks she longs for rest, a carefree afternoon, to decide suddenly to go to the pictures or just sit with the bird cages and listen to the children play in snow. This notion of rest, it's attractive to her, but I don't think she would like it. They are all like that, these women, waiting for the ease, the space that need not be filled with anything other than the drift of their own thoughts. But they wouldn't like it. They are busy and thinking of ways to be busier because such a space of nothing pressing to do would knock them down. No fields of cowslips will rush into that opening. No mornings free of flies and heat when the light is shy. So Violet sprinkles the collars and cuffs, then sudses with all her heart those 3 or 4 ounces of gray hair, soft and interesting as a baby's. Not the kind of baby hair her grandmother had soaped and played with and remembered for 40 years. The hair of the little boy who got his name from it. Maybe that's why Violet is a hairdresser. All those years of listening to her rescuing grandmother, Truebell, tell Baltimore stories. The years with Miss Vera Louise in the fine stone house on Edison Street, where the linen was embroidered with blue thread, and there was nothing to do but raise and adore the blonde boy who ran away from them, depriving everybody of his carefully loved hair. Folks were furious when Violet broke up the funeral, but I can't believe they were surprised. Way, way before that, before Joe ever laid eyes on the girl, Violet sat down in the middle of the street. She didn't stumble, nor was she pushed. She just sat down. After a few minutes, 2 men and a woman came to her, but she couldn't make out why or what they said. They carried her to the nearest steps. Slowly she came around, dusted off her clothes, and got to her appointment an hour late. which pleased the slow-moving whores who never hurried anything but love. Joe never learned of Violet's public craziness. Stuck, just Stan and other male friends couldn't bring themselves to say much more to him than, "How is Violet? Doing okay, is she?" Her private cracks, however, were known to him. I call them cracks because that is what they were, not openings or breaks, but dark fissures in the globe light of the day. She wakes up in the morning and sees with perfect clarity a string of small, well-lit scenes. In each one, something specific is being done. Food things, work things, customers and acquaintances are encountered, places entered. But she doesn't see herself doing these things. She sees them being done. The globe light holds and bathes each scene. And it can be assumed that at the curve, where the light stops, is a solid foundation. In truth, there is no foundation at all, but alleyways, crevices, one steps across all the time. But the globe light is imperfect, too. Closely examined, it shows seams, ill-glued cracks, and weak places beyond which is anything, anything at all. Sometimes when Violet isn't paying attention, she stumbles into these cracks, like the time when, instead of putting her left heel forward, she stepped back and folded her legs in order to sit in the street. For Violet, who never knew the girl, only her picture and the personality she invented for her, based on careful investigations, the girl's memory is a sickness in the house. Everywhere, nowhere. There's nothing for Violet to beat or hit. And when she has to, just has to strike it somehow, there's nothing. Nothing left but straw or sepia print. But for Joe, it's different. That girl had been his necessary thing for 3 months of nights. Now he lies in bed, remembering every detail of that October afternoon when he first met her. From start to finish, and over, not just because it's tasty, but because he's trying to sear her into his mind, brand her there against future wear, so that neither she nor the alive love of her will fade or scab over the way it had with Violet. When he called on Sheila to deliver her Cleopatra order, he entered a room full of laughing, teasing women, and there she was, standing at the door, holding it open for him, the same girl that had distracted him in the drugstore. The girl buying candy and ruining her skin had moved him so his eyes burned. Then suddenly, there in Alice Manfred's doorway, she stood, toes pointing in, hair braided, not even smiling, but welcoming him in for sure, for sure. Otherwise, he wouldn't have had the audacity, the nerve, to whisper to her at the door as he left. Later, he didn't yearn or pine for the girl. Rather, he thought about her and decided. Just as he had decided on his name, the walnut tree he and Victory slept in, a piece of bottomland and wind ahead for the city, he decided on Dorcas. Regarding his marriage to Violet, he hadn't chosen that, but was grateful, in fact, that he didn't have to, that Violet did it for him, helping him escape all the red wings in the county and the right silence that accompanied them. They had met in Vesper County, Virginia, under a walnut tree. She had been working in the fields like everybody else and stayed past picking time to live with a family 20 miles away from her own. They knew people in common and suspected they had at least one relative in common. They were drawn together because they'd been put together, and all they decided for themselves was when and where to meet at night. Violet and Joe left Tyrell, a railway stop through Vesper County, in 1906, and boarded the colored section of the Southern Sky. When the train trembled, approaching the water surrounding the city, they thought it was like them, nervous at having gotten there at last, but terrified or what was on the other side. Eager, a little scared, they didn't even nap during the 14 hours of a ride smoother than a rocking cradle. The quick darkness in the carriage cars when they shot through a tunnel made them wonder if maybe there was a wall ahead to crash into or cliff hanging over nothing. The train shivered with them at the thought, but went on, and sure enough, there was ground up ahead, and the trembling became the dancing under their feet. Joe stood up, his fingers clutching the baggage rack above his head. He felt the dancing better that way, and told Violet to do the same. They were hanging there, a young country couple, laughing and tapping back at the tracks, entering the lip of the city, dancing all the way. Her hip bones rubbed his thigh as they stood in the aisle, unable to stop smiling. They weren't even there yet, and already the city was speaking to them. They were dancing. And like a million others, chest pounding, tracks controlling their feet, they stared out the windows for first sight of the city that danced with them, proving already how much it loved them. Like a million more, they could hardly wait to get there and love it back. 20 years after Joe and Violet train danced on into the city, they were still a couple, but barely speaking to each other. Convinced that he alone remembers those days and wants them back, aware of what it looked like, but not at all of what it felt like, he coupled himself elsewhere. He rented a room from a neighbor who knows the exact cost of her discretion. 6 hours a week he's purchased. Time for the city sky to move from a thin ice blue to purple with a heart of gold. And time enough when the sun sinks to tell his new love things he never told his wife. Important things, like how the hibiscus smells on the bank of a stream at dusk, how he can barely see his knees poking through the holes in his trousers in that light. So what makes him think he can see her hand? Even if she did decide to shove it through the bushes and confirm, once and for all, that she was indeed his mother. And even though the confirmation would shame him, it would make him the happiest boy in Virginia. "Just a sign," he said. "Just show me your hand," he said. "And I'll know, don't you know? I have to know." Maybe she did it. Maybe those were her fingers moving like that in the bush, not twigs. But in light so small, he couldn't see his knees poking through the holes in his trousers. Maybe he missed the sign. That would have been some combination of shame and pleasure at least, and not the inside nothing he traveled with from then on, except for the fall of 1925, when he had somebody to tell it to. Somebody called Dorcas, with hooves tracing her cheekbones, and who knew better than people his own age what that inside nothing was like, and who filled it for him, just as he filled it for her, because she had it too. Maybe her nothing was worse since she knew her mother and had even been slapped in the face by her for some sass she couldn't remember. Of all the slaps she got, that one was the one she remembered best because it was the last. She leaned out the window of her best girlfriend's house because the shouts were not part of what she was dreaming. They were outside her head, across the street, like the running, everybody running, for water, buckets, the fire engine, polished and poised in another part of town. There was no getting in that house where her clothespin dolls lay in a row and a cigar box. But she tried anyway to get them, barefoot in the dress she'd slept in. She ran to get them and yelled to her mother that the box of dolls was up there on the dresser. "Can we get them, Mama?" She cries again, and Joe holds her close. The Iroquois sky passes the window, and if they do see it, it crayon colors their love. That would be when, after a decent silence, he would lift his sample case of Cleopatra from the chair and tease her before opening it, holding up the lid so she could not see right away what he has hidden under the jars and perfume sweet boxes. The present he has brought for her, That is the little bow that ties up their day. At the same time, the city sky is changing its orange heart to black in order to hide its stars for the longest time before passing them out one by one by one like gifts. They try not to shout, but can't help it. Sometimes he covers her mouth with the palm of his hand so no one passing in the hall will hear her. And if he can, if he thinks of it in time, he bites the pillow to stop his own yell. If he can. Sometimes he thinks he has stopped it because the corner of the pillow is in his mouth hole, right? And then he hears himself breathing in and out, at the tail end of a shout that could only have come from his weary throat. She laughs at that, laughs and laughs, before she straddles his back to pound it with her fists. Then when she's exhausted and he half asleep, she leans down, her lips behind his ear, and makes plans. Mexico, she whispers. I want you to take me to Mexico. Too loud, he murmurs. No, no, she says. It's just right. How do you know? He demands. I heard people say. People say the tables are round and have white cloths over them and wee baby lampshades. It don't open till way past your bedtime, he says, smiling. This my bedtime, she says. Mexico people sleep in the day. Take me. I just want to dance with you and then go sit at a round table with a lamp on it. People can see us, he says. Those little lamps you're talking about big enough to show who's there. You always say that, she giggles. Like last time, and nobody even looked at us. They were having such a good time. And Mexico's better even because nobody can see under the tablecloth, can they? Can they? If you don't want to dance, we can just sit there at the table, looking city by the lamplight, and listen to the music, and watch the people. Nobody can see under the tablecloth. Joe, take me. Say you'll take me. How are you going to get out the house, he asks. I'll figure it, she croons, just like always. Just say yes. Well, he says, well, no point in picking the apple if you don't want to see how it tastes. How does it taste, Joe? She asks, and he opens his eyes. Malvon lived alone with newspapers and other people's stories printed in small books. When she wasn't making her office building sparkle, she was melding the print stories with her keen observation of the people around her. Very little escaped this woman who rode the trolley against traffic at 6 p.m., who examined the trash baskets of powerful white men, looked at photographs of women and children on their desks, heard their hallway conversation and the bathroom laughter penetrating the broom closet like fumes from her bottle of ammonia. But Malvon was not interested in these people. She simply noticed her interest lay in the neighborhood people. Before Sweetness changed his name from William Younger to Little Caesar, he robbed a mailbox on 130th Street. Looking for postal notes, cash, or what, Malvon couldn't imagine. She'd raised him from the time he was 7 and a better-behaved nephew no one could have wished for, in the daytime anyway. But some of the things he got into during Malvon's office shift from 6 o'clock to 2:30 a.m. she would never know. Others she learned after he left for Chicago. Or was it San Diego? Or some other city ending with O? One of the things she learned explained where her grocery bag had gone, the 20-pound salt sack she carried, nicely laundered and folded in her purse to market. When she found it, behind the radiator in Sweetness's room, it was full of uncanceled letters. As she examined them, her first impulse was to try to reseal and refold their contents and get them quickly into a mailbox. She ended, however, by reading each one, including those Sweetness had not bothered to tear open. Except for the pleasure of recognizing the signatures, the reading turned out to be flatly uninteresting. Dear Helen Moore, questions about Helen's health, answers about the writer's own, weather, deceptions, promises. A few of the letters required action on Malvon's part. A high school student had sent a matchbook application to a correspondence law school, along with a required, but now missing, dollar bill. Malvon didn't have a dollar to spare for Lila Spencer's entrance fee, but she did worry that if the girl did not get to be a lawyer, she would end up with an apron job. So she added a note in her own hand saying, "I do not have the $1 right this minute, but as soon as I hear that you received this application and agreed that I should come, I will have it by then if you tell me you don't have it and really need it." There was only one letter to sweat over. The writer lived in the same building as her lover. Malvon didn't know what made her waste a 3-cent stamp, other than the pleasure of knowing the government was delivering her heat. Perspiring and breathing lightly, Malvon forced herself to read the letter several times. The problem was whether to send on to Mr. M. Sage. That was what he was called on the envelope. On the sheet of tablet paper, he was called Daddy. His letter from "You're Always Hot Steam." A month had passed since it was written, and Steam might be wondering if she'd gone too far. Or had Daddy Sage and Steam done more of those low-down, sticky things in the meantime? Finally, she decided to mail it with a note of her own, attached, urging caution. It was while she was preparing this anonymous advice that Joe Trace knocked on her door. "How you doing, Malvon?" "Not complaining. How about you?" "Can I step in? Got a proposition for you." He smiled, his easy, country smile. "I don't have a nickel, Joe." "No," he held up his hand and walked past her into the living room. "I'm not selling, see? I don't even have my case with me." "Oh, well then." Malvon followed him to the sofa. "Have a seat." "But if I was," he said, "what would you like? If you had a nickel, I mean." "That purple soap was kind of nice." "You got it." "Went in a flash, though," said Malvon. "Fancy soap is fancy. Not meant to last." "Guess not. I got 2 left. I'll bring them up right away." "What brings this on? You ain't selling. You're giving away free for what reason?" "A favor, you might say." Malvon laughed. "Out with it, Joe. This something Violet ain't in on." "Well, cheap. This is... Vi's... I'm not going to disturb her with this, you know?" "No. Tell me." "Well, I'd like to rent your place."
"What?"
"Just an afternoon or two every now and then, while you at work, but I'll pay you for the whole month." "I don't think I like what you're proposing." $2 each and every month." "You think I need your money or your flimsy soap?" "No, no, Malvon. Look, let me explain. Ain't many women like you understand the problems men have with their wives." "What kind of problem?"
"Well, Violet, you know how funny she's been since her change."
"Violet funny way before that. Funny in 1920, as I recall."
"Yeah, well, but now, Joe, you want to rent Sweetness Room to bring another woman in here while I'm gone just 'cause Violet don't want no part of you? What kind of person you think I am? Okay, there's no love lost between Violet and me, but I take her part, not yours, you old dog.
Violet takes better care of her parrot than she does me. Any other man be running around, stepping out every night, you know that, but I ain't like that. I ain't." Of course he wasn't, but he did it anyway. Sneaked around, plotted, and stepped out every night the girl demanded. They went to Mexico, Sooks, and clubs whose names changed every week, and he was not alone. He became a Thursday man, and Thursday men are satisfied. I can tell from their look some outlaw love is about to be or already has been satisfied. Weekends and other days of the week are possibilities, but Thursday is the day to be counted on. For satisfaction, pure and deep, for balance and pleasure and comfort, Thursday can't be beat. As is clear from the capable expression on the faces of the men and their conquering stride in the street. They seem to achieve some sort of completion on that day.
that makes them steady enough on their feet to appear graceful even if they are not. They command the center of the sidewalk, whistle softly in unlit doors. Thursday men make the women smile. The tunes whistled through perfect teeth are remembered, picked up later, and repeated at the kitchen stove. In front of the mirror near the door, one of them will turn her head to the side and sway, enchanted with her waistline and the shape of her hips. Up there, in that part of the city, which is the part they came for, the right tune whistled in a doorway or lifting up from the circles and grooves of a record can change the weather from freezing to hot to cool. Like that day in July, almost 10 years back, when the beautiful men were cold. In typical summer weather, sticky and bright, Alice Manfred stood for 3 hours on Fifth Avenue, marveling at the cold black faces and listening to drums, saying what the graceful women and the marching men could not. It was July, 1917, and the beautiful faces were cold and quiet, moving slowly into the space the drums were building for them. During the march, it seemed to Alice as though the day passed, the night too, and still she stood there, the hand of the little girl in her own, staring into each cold face that passed. The drums and the freezing faces hurt her, but hurt was better than fear, and Alice had been frightened for a long time. Recently, she had begun to feel safe nowhere south of 110th Street, and Fifth Avenue was for her the most fearful of all. That was where white men leaned out of motor cars with folded dollar bills peeping from their palms. It was where salesmen touched her, and only her, as though she were part of the goods they had condescended to sell her. It was the tissue required if the management was generous enough to let you try on a blouse, but no hat, in a store. It was where she, a woman of 50, an independent means, had no surname, where women who spoke English said, "Don't sit there, honey, you never know what they have." Now, down Fifth Avenue from curb to curb, came a tide of cold black faces, speechless and unblinking, because what they meant to say but did not trust themselves to say, the drum said for them. And what they had seen with their own eyes and through the eyes of others, the drums described to a T. The hurt hurt her, but the fear was gone at last. Fifth Avenue was put into focus now, and so was her protection of the newly orphaned girl in her charge. From then on, she hid the girl's hair in braids tucked under, lest white men see it raining round her shoulders and push dollar-wrapped fingers toward her. She taught her how to crawl along the walls of buildings, disappear into doorways, cut across corners choked in traffic, how to do anything, move anywhere, to avoid a white boy over the age of 11. Much of this she could effect with her dress, but as the girl grew older, more elaborate specifications had to be put into place. High-heeled shoes with the graceful straps across the arch, the vampy hats closed on the head with saucy brims framing the face, makeup of any kind, all of that was outlawed in Alice Manfred's house. Especially the coat slung low in the back but not buttoned, clutched like a bathrobe or a towel around the body, forcing the women who wore them to look like they had just stepped out of the bathtub and were already ready for bed. When Alice Manfred collected the little girl from the Miller sisters, who looked after her on the days Alice's fine stitching was solicited, the three women sat down in the kitchen to hum and sigh over cups of postum at the signs of imminent demise, such as not just ankles, but knees in full view, lip rouge red as hellfire, burnt matchsticks rubbed on eyebrows, fingernails tipped with blood. You couldn't tell the streetwalkers from the mothers. The three women didn't know for sure, but they suspected that the dances were beyond nasty because the music was getting worse and worse. With each passing season, the Lord waited to make himself known. Songs that used to start in the head and fill the heart had dropped down, down, to
to places below the sash and the buckled belts. Alice thought the low-down music had something to do with the silent black men and women marching down Fifth Avenue to advertise their anger over 200 dead in East St. Louis, two of whom were her sister and brother-in-law, killed in the riots. Some said the rioters were disgruntled veterans who had fought in all-colored units, were refused the services of the YMCA over there and over here, and came home to white violence more intense than when they enlisted. Others said they were whites, terrified by the wave of Southern Negroes flooding the towns, searching for work and places to live. Alice, however, believed she knew the truth better than everybody. Her brother-in-law was not a veteran, and he'd been living in East St. Louis since before the war. Nor did he need a white man's job. He owned a pool hall. As a matter of fact, he wasn't even in the riot. He was pulled off a streetcar and stomped to death. And Alice's sister had just got the news and had gone back home to try and forget the color of his entrails when her house was torched, and she burned crispy in its flame. Her only child, a little girl named Dorcas, sleeping across the road with her very best girlfriend, didn't hear the fire engine clanging and roaring down the street, because when it was called, it didn't come. Alice thought, no, it was the music. The dirty, get-on-down music made you do unwise, disorderly things. Just hearing it was like violating the law. Her niece, of course, didn't have the problem. Alice had raised her carefully since she was 8 years old, and although her earliest memory when she arrived from East St. Louis was the parade her aunt took her to, a kind of funeral parade for her mother and her father, Dorcas remembered it differently. The drums she heard at the parade were only the first part, the first word of a command. She remembered them as a beginning, a start of something she looked forward to complete. Back in East St. Louis, as the house burned, wood chips, ignited and smoking, exploded in the air. One of them must have entered her stretched, dumb mouth and traveled down her throat, because it smoked and glowed there still. Dorcas never let it out and never put it out. At first she thought if she spoke of it, it would leave her, or she would lose it through her mouth. And when her aunt took her on a train to the city and crushed her hand while they watched a long parade, the bright wood chip sank further and further down until it lodged comfortably somewhere below her navel. She watched the black, unblinking men, and the drums assured her that the glow would never leave her, that it would be waiting for and with her whenever she wanted to be touched by it. And whenever she wanted to let it loose, to leap into fire again, whatever happened would be quick, like the dolls. There was a night in her 16th year when Dorcas stood in her body and offered it to either of the brothers for a dance. Both boys were shorter than she, and both were equally attractive. More to the point, they outstepped everybody so completely that when they needed tough competition, they were forced to dance with themselves. Sneaking out to the party with her best friend Felice ought to have been hard to arrange, but Alice Manfred had overnight business in Springfield, and nothing could have been easier. Music soars to the ceiling and through the windows wide open for circulation as they enter. Immediately, both girls are snatched by male hands into the dancing center of the room. Dorcas dances well, not as fast as some others, but she's graceful in spite of those shaming shoes, and she is provocative. It's after two more dances that she notices the brothers commanding the attention of a crowd in the dining room. On the street, in vestibules as well as house parties, they are spectacular, moving like taut silk or loose metal. The stomach jumps Dorcas and Felice have agreed is the sign of real interest and possible love
surfaces and spreads as Dorcas watches the brothers. The sandwiches are gone now, the potato salad too, and everybody knows that the time for lights-out music is approaching. The unbelievable agility, the split-second timing the brothers are putting on display, announces the culmination of the fast-dancing segment of the party. Dorcas moves into the hall that parallels the living and dining room. From its shadows, through the archway, she has an unrestricted view of the brothers. Their smiles, more than flawless teeth, are amused and inviting. Someone fights with a Victrola, places the arm on, scratches the record, tries again, then exchanges the record for another. During the lull, the brothers notice Dorcas. Taller than most, she gazes at them over the head of her dark friend. The brothers' eyes seem wide and welcoming to her. She moves forward out of the shadow and slips through the group. The right record is on the turntable now. She can hear its preparatory hiss as the needle slides toward its first groove. The brothers smile brilliantly. One leans a fraction of an inch toward the other, and never losing eye contact with Dorcas, whispers something. The other looks Dorcas up and down as she moves toward them. Then, just as the music, slow and smoky, loads up the air, his smile bright as ever, he wrinkles his nose and turns away. The stomach jump of possible love is nothing compared to the ice flows that block up her veins now. The body she inhabits is unworthy. So by the time Joe Trace whispered to her through the crack of a closing door, her life had become almost unbearable. The flesh, heavily despised by the brothers, held secret the love appetite soaring inside it. Very few knew that Joe met Dorcas in Alice Manfred's house, right up under her nose and right before her very eyes. If I remember right, that October lunch in Alice Manfred's house, something was off. Alice was vague, and anybody in her company for 30 minutes knew that wasn't her style. She was polite, of course, not too haughty either, but not paying close attention to things. Distracted, she was. About Dorcas, probably. I always believed that girl was a pack of lies. I could tell by her walk her underclothes were beyond her years, even if her dress wasn't. Maybe back in October, Alice was beginning to think so, too. By the time January came, nobody had to speculate. Everybody knew. I wonder if she had a premonition of Joe Trace knocking on her door. Or it could have been something she read in all those newspapers stacked neatly along the baseboard in her bedroom. Everybody needs a pile of newspapers to peel potatoes on, serve bathroom needs, wrap garbage, but not like Alice Manfred. She must have read them over and over, else why would she keep them? If she read anything in the newspaper twice, she knew too little about too much. If you have secrets you want kept, or want to figure out those other people have, a newspaper can turn your mind. The best thing to find out what's going on is to watch how people maneuver themselves in the streets. Do they walk right through the boys, kicking cans along the sidewalk, or holler at them to quit? Ignore the men sitting on car fenders, or stop to exchange a word? One thing for sure, the streets will confuse you, teach you, or break your head. But Alice Manfred wasn't the kind to give herself reasons to be in the streets. She got through them quick as she could to get back to her house. If she'd come out more often, sat on the stoop, or gossiped in front of the beauty shop, she would have known more than what the paper said. She might have known what was happening under her nose. When she did find out what took place between that October day and the awful January 1 that ended everything, the last people on earth she wanted to see was Joe Trace or anybody connected to him. It happened, though. The woman who avoided the streets led into her living room the woman who sat down in the middle of one.
Idle and withdrawn in her grief and shame, Alice Manfred whittled away the days, making lace for nothing, reading her newspapers, tossing them on the floor, picking them up again. She read them differently now. Every week since Dorcas's death, during the whole of January and February, a paper laid bare the bones of some broken woman. Man kills wife, 8 accused of rape dismissed, woman and girls victims of, woman commits suicide, white attackers indicted, 5 women caught, woman says man beat, in jealous rage man. Defenseless as ducks, she thought. Or were they? Read carefully, the news accounts revealed that most of these women, subdued and broken, had not been defenseless, or, like Dorcas, easy prey. All over the country, black women were armed. Natural prey, easy pickings. I don't think so. Aloud, she said it, I don't think so. Worn spots in the linen had been strengthened with 60 weight thread. Laundered and folded, it lay in a basket her mother had used. Alice raised the ironing board and spread newspaper under it to keep the hems clean. She was waiting not only for the irons to heat, but also for a brutal woman, black as soot, known to carry a knife. She waited with less hesitation than she had before, and with none of the scary, angry feeling she had in January, when a woman saying she was Violet Trace had tried to see her, talk or something, knocked on her door so early in the morning, Alice thought it was the law. I don't have a thing to say to you, not one thing. She had said it in a loud whisper through the chained opening of the door and slammed it shut. She didn't need the name to be afraid or to know who she was, the star of her niece's funeral. Violent, they called her now. What could you want from me? Oh, right now I just want to sit down on your chair, Violet said. I'm sorry, I just can't think what good can come of this. I'm having trouble with my head, said Violet, placing her fingers on the crown of her hat. See a doctor, why don't you? Violet walked past her, drawn like a magnet to a small side table. Is that her? Alice didn't have to look to know what she was staring at. Yes. The long pause that followed, while Violet examined the face that loomed out of the frame, made Alice nervous. Before she got up the courage to ask the woman to leave, she turned away from the photograph, saying, I'm not the one you need to be scared of. No? Who is? I don't know. That's what hurts my head. You didn't come here to say you're sorry? I thought maybe you did. You came in here to deliver some of your own evil. I don't have no evil of my own. I think you'd better go. Let me rest here a minute. I can't find a place where I can just sit down. That's her there? I just told you it was. She give you a lot of trouble? No, none. Well, some. I was a good girl her age. Never gave a speck of trouble. I did everything anybody told me till I got here. City make you tighten up. Odd acting, thought Alice, but not bloody-minded. And before she could think not to let it happen, the question was out. Why did he do such a thing? Why did she? Why did you? I don't know. The second time she came, Alice was pulling the curtain to cut off the light that smashed right into her visitor's eyes when she said, Your husband, does he hurt you? Joe? No. He never heard nothing. Except Dorcas. And squirrels. What? Rabbits, too. Deer, possum, pheasant. We eat good down home. Why'd you leave? Landowner didn't want rabbit. He wants soft money. They want money here, too. But there's a way to get it here. I did day work when I first came here. 3 houses a day got me good money. Joe cleaned fish at night. Took a while before he got hotel work. I got into hairdressing and Joe... I don't want to hear about all that. Violet shut up and stared at the photograph. Alice gave it to her to get her out of the house. Next day she was back and looked so bad, Alice wanted to slap her. Instead she said, "Take that dress off and I'll stitch up your cuff." Violet wore the same dress each time, and Alice was irritated by the thread running loose from her sleeve, as well as the coat lining, ripped in at least 3 places she could see. Violet sat in her slip with her coat on, while Alice mended the sleeve with the tiniest stitches. At no time did Violet take off her hat. Alice had finished the sheets and begun the first shirtwaist when Violet knocked on her door. Years and years and years ago, she had guided the tip of the iron into the seams of a man's white shirt. Dampened just so, the fabric smoothed and tightened with starch. Those shirts were scraps now, dust cloths, monthly cloths, rags tied around pipe joints to hinder freezing, potholders and pieces to test hot irons and wrap their handles, even wicks for oil lamps, salt bags to scrub the teeth. Now her own shirt waists got her elegant, attentive hand care. By now she recognized the knock and never knew if she was eager or angry when she heard it, and she didn't care. When Violet came to visit, and Alice never knew when that might be, something opened up. The thing was how Alice felt and talked in her company, not like she did with other people. With Violet, she was impolite, sudden, frugal. No apology or courtesy seemed required or necessary between them. But something else was, clarity, perhaps, the kind of clarity crazy people demand from the not crazy. Alice sighed a little sigh, amazed at herself as she opened the door to the only visitor she looked forward to. She handed Violet tea. "I don't understand women like you, women with knives." She snatched up a long-sleeved blouse and smoothed it over the ironing board. "I wasn't born with a knife." "No, but you picked one up." "You never did?" Violet blew ripples into the tea. "No, I never did. Even when my husband ran off, I never did that. And you, you didn't even have a worthy enemy, somebody worth killing. You picked up a knife to insult a dead girl." "But that's better, ain't it? The harm was already done." "She wasn't the enemy." "Oh, yes, she is. She's my enemy. Then when I didn't know it, and now too." "Why? Because she was young and pretty and took your husband away from you?" Violet sipped her tea and didn't answer. After a long silence, and after their talk had turned to trifles, then on to the narrowness of life, Violet said to Alice Manfred, "Wouldn't you? You wouldn't fight for your man?" Alice heard a question like the pop of a toy gun. Somewhere in Springfield, only the teeth were left. Maybe the skull, maybe not. No lips to share with the woman she had shared them with. No fingers to lift her hips as he had lifted others. Just the teeth exposed now. Nothing like the smile that had made her say, "Choose." And he did. What Alice told Violet was true. She had never picked up a knife. What she neglected to say was also true. Every day and every night for 7 months, she, Alice Manfred, was starving for blood. Not his, oh no. For him she planned sugar in his motor, scissors to his tie, burned suits, slashed shoes, ripped socks, but no blood. Her craving settled on the red liquid coursing through the other woman's veins. The dream that plumped her pillow at night was seeing herself mount a horse, then ride it, and find the woman alone on a road, and gallop till she ran her down under 4 iron hooves, then back again and again, until there was nothing left but tormented road dirt, signaling where the hussy had been. He had chosen, so would she, and maybe after galloping through 7 months of nights, on a horse she neither owned nor knew how to ride, over the twitching, pulpy body of a woman who wore white shoes in winter,
laughed loud as a child, and had never seen a marriage license. Maybe she would have done something wild. But after 7 months, she had to choose something else. The suit, the tie, the shirt he liked best. They suggested she not waste the shoes. No one would see them.